to the Richard Nixon Experience.
He cared for people, not for numbers. So desperately did he want a just and lasting peace, so much did he want us to reason together, so much did he yearn that man's goodness would triumph over man's evil. So often, as friend turned to political foe, did he nod with sad understanding and pray that in the years to come, the sacrifices he was making would be worthy of the American people and serve ultimately as a firm platform on which to build a better America.
Johnson was an open man, a secretive man, a cantankerous man, a generous man. He was famous in the Senate for his ability to wheel and deal, and he used that ability, that uncanny knack he had for judging other men, to force passage of the most significant civil rights laws this country has ever known. But he could also be a stubborn man, one who almost never bent to contrary opinion. As president, he pursued the war in Vietnam, and it was a belated realization of the country's mood that caused him not to run again for the presidency. But as was said of another man, taken all in all, we shall not see his like again. He had many, many friends and fewer enemies than friends. Those who loved him and those who did not will miss him greatly. He was a giant figure on the American scene and a man for whom the presidency constituted the most serious business in his life. Good night for NBC News. When he left the White House in 1968, Lyndon Johnson said his greatest disappointment was his failure to bring peace to Vietnam. Tonight, on the eve of that peace, the body of the former president lies in state in the Johnson Library in Austin, Texas. Today, Mrs. Johnson said that instead of gifts or flowers, those who want to express their sympathy should do so by doing something to make life in their communities a little better.
The former president's body was returned from San Antonio near midnight last night. He was taken to a funeral home in Austin, Texas. Austin is the closest large city to the Johnson family ranch, a distance of about 50 miles away. This morning, following a prayer service, a military honor guard removed the president's body. The prayer service was very small and very private. There was Mrs. Johnson, the Johnson daughters, their husbands, Lynn Nugent, the president's oldest grandchild, and a few close family friends. The service was led by two ministers, also old family friends. Mrs. Johnson was escorted by retired Air Force General James Cross. General Cross was the president's pilot during the Johnson White House years. The president's body was then driven a short distance to the Lyndon Johnson Library. Don Oliver was there.
This was his work after he was president, building this, his legacy, the LBJ Library. President Johnson never made any formal plans for his funeral. His family was up most of the night deciding what he would have wanted. Several thousand mourners were here, lined up as long as 4 hours before the casket arrived. Inside, on the second floor, Mr. Johnson's casket was placed in front of a pylon on which were inscribed his favorite quotes and his speeches. Family and friends came in for a short prayer service beside the casket. Then Mrs. Johnson, her daughters, and their husbands stood in line to thank the hundreds and thousands who filed by to pay tribute. Only Lucy Johnson Nugent appeared close to tears. At the rate of 50 a minute, they filed by, and late into the afternoon, the Johnson family was still there, still saying thank you. Don Oliver, NBC News, Austin.
It's a long way from Blanco County, Texas, to Washington and the White House. Lyndon Johnson made that trip, but he never forgot the area he called home. And while he was president, he returned there often to the LBJ Ranch. And he went home to retire and to die. The people of Blanco County won't forget Lyndon Johnson. Here's a report.
Texans call it the Hill Country. Although the hills seem fairly small by eastern or western standards, it's rocky ground with scrub vegetation, not the most ideal land for ranching. Yet many, including Lyndon Johnson's forebears, did that here and still do. The LBJ Ranch was more retreat than ranch in recent years, but it is where the former president wanted to be. It was where he was born and where he chose to retire. It is also where he chose to be buried, and that will take place here, in the family cemetery, a few hundred yards from the place where he was born. This was Lyndon Johnson's boyhood home. It's in Johnson City. That's about 15 miles from the LBJ Ranch. And it is the largest city in Blanco County, although it isn't saying much. There are no large cities in Blanco County. It's a small town and a quiet town. And it was especially quiet today.
People in town were stunned. Some stores on their own closed. There wasn't much business conducted in Johnson City today. But there was a lot of talk, not about a politician or president, but about a neighbor who just happened to have been both. They wondered how Johnson City should observe the day of his funeral.
Miss Johnson wants, whatever we do, might be real simple. Nothing elaborate.
He called me yesterday about 1 o'clock. We had some business to discuss, and asked him how he felt, and he said, well, I feel better today than I have in the last few days. And then it kind of upset me when I heard about it, because I just talked to him a couple hours before.
We knew that someday this was going to happen, but these things you never prepared for them, really. I think the community as a whole is very saddened. He was a great friend, and we feel like we've lost a great friend in President Johnson.
Lyndon Johnson will be buried in Texas on Thursday, and that day will be a national day of mourning. President Nixon has ordered all federal offices closed, and he has called on all Americans to attend their places of worship and pay homage to the memory of Mr. Johnson. Tributes to the former president continue to be voiced all over the world. One came from a man who knew him very well, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey.
He was a humanitarian for the people that had been ignored and forgotten. That's what I liked about him most. Now, this didn't really always come through. Most people felt, well, he's just doing these things. This is all politics. But that's not true. He never forgot the people that he knew, the Mexican Americans and the black people and the poor people and the farmers. I think that the war has been like a cloud cutting out the light of truth on the Johnson legislative record, this amazing record in the field of social policy and social legislation. I can't say how history will finally judge his role in Vietnam, but I think it will be a different judgment than we've passed on it thus far. Many a president has been involved in Vietnam. Some people feel they couldn't have all been so wrong. This I know, however, that no man sought more diligently to gain peace in Vietnam and was more frustrated in the process than Lyndon Johnson. This was his burden, his sorrow.
Lyndon Johnson's finest accomplishments were in the area of domestic policy, in the expansion of social programs, and in fighting for the rights of black people. No one knew this better than Roy Wilkins, executive director of the NAACP, the oldest Negro civil rights group in the United States. And here are some of what Wilkins had to say about Mr. Johnson.
He was the greatest president on civil rights since Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. Johnson not only gave them the vote and went back and sent federal registrars into the counties that hadn't had any registration of blacks since the Reconstruction, but he also gave them the Civil Rights Act of 1964, an omnibus bill that included employment, equal employment opportunities, and all the other things that his was a tremendous legacy to the black people in their struggle in this country.
Into effect. And today, a former president was laid to rest. The funeral of Lyndon Johnson, 36th president of the United States, was held today in Washington. Then his body was flown back to Texas, and he was buried in the family cemetery on his ranch. All last night, people came to the Capitol to pay their last respects to Mr. Johnson. 40,000 people passed his bier as he lay in state in the Capitol rotunda. This morning, Mr. Johnson's body was taken to the National City Christian Church in Washington for the funeral service.
Is the National City Christian Church. It's about 2 miles from the Capitol building. It's the church where Mr. Johnson attended his last service as president, a service in which he heard a prayer he had written for the occasion. The route of the motorcade from the Capitol is west along Constitution Avenue, then northwest on Pennsylvania Avenue to 14th Street, and finally north on 14th Street to the church at Thomas Circle, and that's at the convergence of Vermont and Massachusetts Avenue. This was President Johnson's favorite church. He felt particularly close to the minister of the church. The service there is expected to last no more than 40 minutes. We're now going to go to the church where Paul Duke is for the beginning of the services.
And Barbara, the motorcade is now pulling up to the church. And President Nixon and Mrs. Nixon are arriving. The Nixon daughters and Edward Cox and President Nixon and Mrs. Nixon. First family now walking up the steps into the church. The organ meditation now includes some of the favorite hymns of President and Mrs. Johnson. And now inside the church is Lee McCarthy.
The church has been filling up since about 8:30 this morning. It's now about half full. Many of the members of the Johnson administration are here. We have seen from our vantage point, which is in the balcony, Robert McNamara, Nicholas Katzenbach, Lawrence O'Brien, Abe Fortas came in a little while ago. Also, Bobby Baker, one of the sad points in President Johnson's career, the scandal which surrounded Bobby Baker and eventually sent him to prison. Back out front, the church and Paul Duke.
And now the motorcade bearing the body President Johnson begins to reach Thomas Circle where the church is situated. It's 10 a.m. in Washington. As you have seen, the casket bearing the body of the late president is now being carried into the church, where the congregation and guests are in place, and the service is about to start.
He asked those who had much to be concerned for those who had least. He asked us to live up to our national promise. He asked us to be worthy of our heritage, to ourselves. But he never asked more than he was willing to give. Lyndon Johnson loved a woman. She was his greatest joy, and she was his greatest comfort. He loved his children, and he loved his grandchildren. And to see all of them together was a heartwarming experience, for it transcended normal family devotion. And coupled with that, he loved each of us, sometimes with wry amusement at our failures, often with sharp words at our imperfections, but always with a sweeping and generous understanding of our frailties. He is gone from us now, and this afternoon we shall take him home, and he will be forever a part of the Hill Country.
And in Texas, in the family cemetery at his ranch, Mr. Johnson was buried.
Unto him that loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood, and it made us kings and priests unto God and his Father, to him be the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Amen.
Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
We interrupt our regularly scheduled program so that we may bring you the following special report from ABC News. ABC News presents The Peace is Signed. Here is ABC News correspondent Sam Donaldson.
Good morning from New York. Peace is not only at hand, it is here. True, the fighting continues in South Vietnam, but that will last only until 7 o'clock New York time, which is 8 a.m. Sunday morning, because the treaties that bring peace into effect are being signed today in Paris, in the International Ballroom of the former Hotel Majestic, where for over 5 years the peace treaty was hammered out, actually just the last few months, as we now know, the real progress made. There are two treaties, two signings, rather, that have taken place today. One has already taken place. That was at 5 o'clock New York time, 11 o'clock in the morning in Paris. We're going to show you that one in just a moment, the videotaped highlights, and then a second signing, and we will show you that taking place live from Paris. The first signing involved all four parties to the Vietnam conflict: the United States, North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the Viet Cong, or what is now known as the Provisional Revolutionary Government. Here are the characters, the people that actually showed up to do the signing. Secretary of State William Rogers for the United States was there. All of these are the foreign ministers of their various governments. Seated at the round table, there the foreign minister of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, that we know as North Vietnam, Nguyen Duy Trinh. He signed for North Vietnam. For the Viet Cong, or Provisional Revolutionary Government, it used to be the old NLF, Madam Nguyen Thi Binh, the foreign minister for the PRG. And for Saigon's government, Tran Van Lam, the foreign minister representing President Chu. Those are the four people who signed the first signing, the signing that's already taken place in Paris. Let's take a look at how it went by calling in our correspondent there, ABC's Lu Chiaffi.
The day began here in Paris, cold, wet, and gloomy. Around the now famous Majestic Hotel, an impressive security force. It was here that for almost 5 years there were negotiations that seemed frustrating and never got anywhere. Now it's the site where the signing ceremonies took place. There were actually two separate ceremonies. The first was this morning among the four foreign ministers, in a ceremony that was designed to get the two forces in South Vietnam to accept the ceasefire without having to accept each other. South Vietnamese Foreign Minister Lum was the first to arrive, followed almost immediately by the Provisional Revolutionary Government's Foreign Minister, Madam Binh. As usual, she was wearing traditional áo dài, the Vietnamese national dress. After her came the Foreign Minister of North Vietnam, Nguyen Duy Trinh. He had arrived 2 days ago from Hanoi for the signing ceremony. The last of the dignitaries to get to the Majestic Hotel was Secretary of State Rogers. His car had driven by hundreds of demonstrators outside. They were carrying North Vietnamese and Viet Cong flags, and they jeered when Mr. Rogers went by. However, it did not seem to bother him, and he waved cheerfully as he walked between the ranks of a French honor guard into the building. Inside, the round table was set and waiting. Mr. Rogers moved to his place, flanked by his aides, including Ambassador William Porter and Ambassador William Sullivan. At just 6 minutes after 11 a.m. local time, the signing began. Each of the men had to place his signature on the documents 32 times. Secretary Rogers seemed to have a little trouble finding a pen that would write, but he finally succeeded. And with that scratch of a pen, the American involvement in Vietnam was over, and America's longest war was ended. What was being signed was the agreement itself calling for an end to the fighting and three protocols dealing with an international control commission, a joint military commission, and the return of prisoners of war. The document itself does not mention any of the signatory countries by name. It just refers to the parties participating in the Paris Conference on Vietnam. It was the formula to avoid having the South Vietnamese and the Provisional Revolutionary Government recognize each other. Foreign Minister Lum of South Vietnam has already said that Saigon is ready to talk to the Viet Cong, but there is no indication on either side that they're willing to make the kind of concessions that will solve the political problems that still exist and which have not been resolved by this agreement. The copies of the agreement were passed around the table, and it was understandable that there was a slight mix-up, and the books had to be repassed so all was correct and according to protocol. The South Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, by the way, refused to even sign on the same page. They used different pages. Aside from that, the ceremony went smoothly and almost matter-of-factly. There were no statements made. Everyone seemed aware of the importance of the moment, and the mood was almost solemn. The foreign ministers, their aides, and invited guests waited quietly as the final signatures were placed on the documents, and then, just 20 minutes after it had begun, the ceremony was over. The delegations rose and slowly moved out of the conference room, the same place they had spent almost 5 years trying to hammer out the agreement they had just signed. A small champagne reception was scheduled in an anteroom where it's reported the delegations relaxed a bit. Secretary Rogers and Hanoi's Foreign Minister Trinh are reported to have toasted each other, but there's no indication Madam Vinh and Foreign Minister Lum went through the same diplomatic niceties. And that's how the first ceremony went, Sam.
Thank you, Lou. I know that many observers were going to look at that champagne reception to see how the two South Vietnamese parties treated one another, because the agreement, after all, to work really depends on whether the Provisional Revolutionary Government, the Viet Cong, and the Saigon government can get together and fulfill it. Now, the second signing is about to take place, and here by videotape, we take a look at the arrival of the principals for the signing of the second one, which we are about to bring you live. There you see the foreign minister of North Vietnam, Nguyen Thi Trinh. On the left, Xuan Thuy, who was the principal delegate to the Paris peace talks, the public Paris peace talks for all those years. Le Duc Tho, the man who actually hammered out the agreement with Henry Kissinger, is not in Paris today. He left yesterday. And as a matter of fact, Henry Kissinger, of course, is not in Paris. The United States side arriving. Here, Secretary of State William Rogers, back again. He will have signed 72 times by the time these two signing ceremonies have been completed. The various documents, essentially, of course, the same same document, but various copies of it. There are, as Lou has already said, some differences in the two signings. Not only the fact that in the second one there will only be the two parties, North Vietnam and the United States, but in the second one, that fourth protocol, the protocol that actually spells out how the deactivation of the mining that we have had around the harbors of Haiphong and Hanoi will be undertaken. Now let's go to Paris and the second signing, and ABC's John Rolfson.
It takes some rather complicated formalities to end this war. All four of the parties have already signed the agreement in a morning ceremony here in Paris. And now, after a four-hour break, the American and North Vietnamese must sign again, coming back here to the Hotel Majestic in the same big round table. Each of the four foreign ministers has already signed his name on 32 different pages, and a little confusion was understandable. Three of the four skipped a page or two, and the big books had to be sent back to them, which delayed the proceedings about 5 minutes. Now, Secretary Rogers and his North Vietnamese counterpart have to sign 40 more times. Here is Lou Chaffee.
Thank you, John. We're now, again, live from Paris. The conference room itself, the large, enormously large green table, the aides, those are the American aides, some of the technicians who helped hammer out the details of the final agreement in their places. There are places for 20 seats behind each delegation, five people in a delegation. The American delegation, of course, is headed by Secretary of State Rogers, with him Ambassador Sullivan, Ambassador Porter, Marshall Green, and Haywood Isham, who is the acting negotiator here, who took Mr. Porter's place. The American delegation people, I can see Ambassador Sullivan standing at the door in just a few minutes from now. The second signing in this two-part signing ceremony here in Paris, which will finally end American participation in the Vietnam War. Who is with the North Vietnamese delegation, John?
The people who have just filed in and taken their seats are the guests and the staff. We're seeing now the American delegation being seated. Secretary Rogers is not there yet. These are the three aides on the North Vietnamese. This is Mr. Sullivan, and with him came in Marshall Green and Haywood Isham. We see here at the closest Mr. Minh Vi, who is number two to Xuan Thuy in the delegation. Next to him was Mr. Tak, again William Sullivan of the American delegation.
Yeah, Ambassador Sullivan is one of the men who probably worked the hardest outside of Henry Kissinger to hammer out this thing. Not only did he participate in meetings with Lay Duck Tow and Henry Kissinger, but also he headed the American team of technicians who had the tedious and difficult job of hammering out the final details and also the translations.
We can see... Yes, we can see now the big round table with those two small rectangular tables on either sides. If you want to imagine it, the two rectangular tables connected would form a line across the middle of the round table, dividing it in two. And since the very beginning, of course, the Saigon delegation has wished to imagine this line is there, so that there are two sides in this negotiation. The Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, of course, reject this idea of two sides, insisting that there are four delegations. This shape of the table, with the imaginary line for those who wish to imagine and not there for those who wish to ignore, was the great and genius compromise of exactly 4 years ago that permitted the negotiations here in Paris to get started. It took weeks, as you know, to decide how they were going to be seated at the table before they would even start talking. And of course, this same issue is involved in this complicated signing procedure. The South Vietnamese, the Saigon government, does not consider this a signing among four delegations, but a signing between two sides.
Well, as a matter of fact, it's involved also in the treaties, the agreements themselves. That's the reason there are two signings today. The first agreement that was signed this morning did not name any of the countries. Nowhere in it is a mention of the United States and so on. They simply mention the four parties participating in the Paris conference on Vietnam. This agreement that's being signed now does mention the four because the United States and North Vietnam are willing to admit that all four do exist, but Saigon and the Revolutionary Provisional Government do not wish to make that admission.
Yes, both of them to some extent, but particularly Saigon refuses this admission. As one of the Viet Cong delegates said to us the other day, after all these years of fighting, the Viet Cong has never recognized the United States. And as Madam Binh told us, after the peace had been initialed, it was in fact the United States and Saigon which created, as she said, all of these complications about the signing. The Viet Cong would be quite happy to have four delegations, provided it was given equal status. And the Viet Cong does claim that by the form of the treaties and the fact that all of these documents together make a single document, the Viet Cong's status as a government has, in fact, been formally recognized.
Well, one of the little things that shows the sensibility of these various delegations, today, this morning session, I think as we saw already, there were a lot of demonstrators outside who were... waving Viet Cong and North Vietnamese flags. They've been called out by the French Communist Party, by the Humanité, their newspaper here, and they showed up, about 300 French Communists and Vietnamese, and they had a very noisy, lively, gay celebration and demonstration outside. They cheered when the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong arrived. They booed and jeered when the Americans and the South Vietnamese arrived. And after the signing ceremony, South Vietnamese Foreign Minister Lum, who met with French Foreign Minister Schumann, officially protested and against the demonstration, because he said he was under the impression that the French government was not going to allow it. They were singing the Internationale and so on, and there was an official protest.
Well, and it apparently worked, too, because the demonstrators are not there this afternoon. In fact, I'm quite surprised, Lou, that the French permitted them together this morning.
Well, they were at the airport, you know, when Trinh arrived the other day.
But this is something French police can easily stop, isn't it?
John, you were talking a moment ago about recognition. Of course, the United States position is that we recognize only the Saigon government until an election replaces it.
That's correct, that the United States recognizes the Saigon as the one and only government of South Vietnam. Isn't that true? The United States delegation, as you see, is just now seated. The United States has, although recognizing the Saigon government as the only legal government of South Vietnam, the United States is quite willing to put its name on a document which recognizes the Viet Cong as a government, as the Provisional Revolutionary Government of South Vietnam. So this is not a sticking point. That is, at least not the protocol of it with the United States. It's mainly with the Saigon government. Secretary Rogers beginning the signing, and here is North Vietnam's Foreign Minister Trinh beginning the signing. You see, the copies that he has in front of him are bound in red leather. These are the copies that Hanoi, the North Vietnamese government, will keep for themselves. The American copies, bound in blue leather, also four books, which Secretary Rogers is signing now, will be kept by the United States. There are two other sets. That is a brown bound set, which the Saigon government will keep, and a green leather set, which Provisional Revolutionary Government will keep.
This signing, there is one more paper involved in this. They're signing the exact same text as they did before, with the exception, of course, of the identification of the countries. But there is one more protocol that's being signed right now, and that is a protocol involving the picking up or the destruction of the mines that the United States had laid in the harbor of Haiphong. So this time, instead of three protocols in one agreement, there'll be four protocols in one agreement.
Secretary Rogers, as you see, has in front of him two banks of pens, 24 pens altogether. He brought 24 pens into the morning signing as well. That will mean you'll have 48 souvenir pens to give away, with which he can say each one has signed the treaty, isn't that right? The other delegations don't quite do this. The Saigon delegation did use three or four pens. I didn't count them all, but certainly not a bank of them like this. And the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese did not.
Well, the secretary had some problems this morning with some of his pens. It didn't appear to write, and I noticed that before the principals entered the conference room this afternoon, one of the aides in the American delegation tried out the pens to make sure they work.
He tried them out this morning, too, but apparently not all of them are not well enough. There they are, seated across the table from each other, 23 feet away from each other, exactly, across this big, round, green-covered table. To the left of Secretary Rogers is William Porter. To the left of here, Mr. Trinh, is Swan Thuy, the negotiator. Mr. Porter and Mr. Thuy, of course, for the last year and a half have been facing each other across this very table, the last part of the public sessions of these negotiations. And this again, the North Vietnamese delegation, seated in back of the men at the table are 20 others, their staff and guests. Each delegation has been permitted to bring in these 20. The North Vietnamese Foreign Minister. There is a very relaxed mood in this room, as you see, a little bit of chat back and forth among the delegations. They're not saying anything to each other, but that is some talking within each staff.
Well, there is a small anteroom outside where the delegations mingle before and after the signing ceremony. They did mingle this morning, apparently after the first ceremony. Apparently, Mr. Trinh here and Secretary of State Rogers toasted each other in champagne. And we understand from a fairly good source here in the Majestic Hotel that the Viet Cong and the Provisional Revolutionary Government for the first time acknowledged that each other existed. And apparently there was maybe not a toast drunk, but at least they did chat with each other, talk to each other, and admitted that they were in the same room.
If you like, Sam, I could tell you exactly why they have to sign so many times. It's really relatively simple, but you do have to follow it. There is an agreement plus now four protocols. Each must be signed. These exist in two languages, Vietnamese and English. That means then 10 documents. And each of the four delegations has a copy, that is 10 times 4, 40 documents, 40 to be signed. You calculate the morning with one less protocol, there were 32. And so together, morning and afternoon, it makes 72 signatures. Yes, as a matter of fact, Sam, the agreement itself provides, doesn't it, that after it's signed, it'll still be some 9 hours before the ceasefire takes effect.
That's right. 8 o'clock in Vietnam, which is 7 tonight in New York, that is when the ceasefire is to take effect. And prior to that time, activity is going on. And supposedly, of course, once troops are in place, when that deadline, that armistice deadline arrives, they can stay there.
Well, Sam, there's also a psychological thing involved in here. The North Koreans during the Korean War did almost the same thing. When they knew that a ceasefire was about to be signed and the war was to end, they started a last-minute offensive to give the impression that when the war ended, they were on the offensive, they were winning, and therefore it had to be the other side that was suing for peace. And I think there's a little bit of that involved right now on the part of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to give the impression that even as Secretary of State Rogers is signing the agreement, their troops are on the offensive, are taking new territory, and are winning in Vietnam.
I think you're quite right. We know for the part of the Saigon government on the other side, General Chu, President Chu, has given orders that no South Vietnamese is to return to his former hamlet or home if it is in fact in communist territory. And his troops have been given orders, we are told, to shoot anyone they suspect of being a communist agent on their side of any particular line which demarks their territory and his territory.
Well, Sam, you know, in spite of the wonderful feeling right now and the feeling of reconciliation and the end of war and so on that's happened here in Paris, there is another feeling that this might not last, that while it is peace for the United States and the United States is getting out, that there's not going to be much peace in the future for Vietnam itself. As you well know, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong already have started making their usual charges that the South Vietnamese, if not already, are planning to break the terms of the agreement. The South Vietnamese themselves are making it clear that they're not going to give in and certainly are not going to abandon power to the Provisional Revolutionary Government. And although both say they want to talk, you don't get an indication they really are ready to make important concessions.
Well, just today in Hanoi, there's been a victory celebration. The North Vietnamese Defense Minister, Vo Nguyen Giap, has called for a victory in the struggle and says the struggle must continue now that victory has been won over the United States. So I think very definitely you're correct. These two sides will continue to jockey for position. This agreement that's being signed right now before our eyes provides for very delicate mechanisms for carrying out elections, but either side could torpedo those mechanisms. And the alternative would be, I suppose, theoretically, for the United States to go back in, but I don't know of anyone in Washington who thinks that's even a remote possibility. And I know that at Henry Kissinger's news conference the other day, when he was explaining these agreements and what they stood for, without
it's
saying it in
over,
so
Sam.
Many words, he made it clear we wouldn't.
That's it, Sam. It's all over.
Today, the war ends for the United States in Vietnam.
Securely guaranteed and able to shape its own relationships to all others.
If the United States betrays the millions of people who have relied on us in Vietnam, the President of the United States, whoever he is, will not deserve nor receive the respect which is essential if the United States is to continue to play the great role we are destined to play of helping to build a new structure of peace in the world. It would amount to a renunciation of our morality, an abdication of our leadership among nations, and an invitation for the mighty to prey upon the weak all around the world.
Richard Nixon assumed the presidency in January 1969. The nation was at war, and the world seemed on the brink of nuclear catastrophe. It was the greatest set of challenges facing any incoming president since the end of the Second World War.
Mr. President, America's involvement in Vietnam was regarded by many as a disaster. It was splitting American society at home in a very grievous way for what seemed to many an obscure or even a mistaken reason. How did it look to you, though?
Well, it looked to me first that the reason for our being in Vietnam had perhaps not been adequately understood by the American people. I thought first that Kennedy and Johnson were right in going in Vietnam. I was very critical of the way the war had been conducted. I thought they could have done, particularly President Johnson, because, of course, he had the major responsibility. We were in deeper by the time he was president, that they could have conducted it in a more effective way. I had some ideas as to what could be done, but I wasn't about to go down that easy political path of bugging out, blaming it on my predecessors. It would have been enormously popular in America, but that would have paid, had been at an enormous cost, eventually even to America, but particularly to the whole free world.
But wasn't staying there, I mean, that was also at a massive cost, wasn't it, in billions of dollars, in 138,000 South Vietnamese killed, half a million Cambodians, half a million North Vietnamese, and so on. That cost, it's a question of weighing one cost against another cost, isn't it? But it you is. Thought that cost was worth paying for what you got.
It was worth it in terms of the period in which I had the responsibility. Let me be quite candid about it. The most popular position to take on Vietnam, if I was simply playing to the votes and playing to popular opinion in the world, was to bug out and blame it on Johnson and Kennedy.
I know.
And I didn't do it. Now, the most popular position for me to take now is to say the whole venture in Vietnam, or everything that we did, was a waste of men, that it was... That it showed the United States at its worst. It cost us a great deal of money. We were morally wrong to be there, go there in the first place. Morally wrong to continue it as long as we did. And it wasn't worth it. And I could say that. And many, perhaps, of those, and that's probably a majority of our viewers who agree with that, might applaud. Even some of my critics, who many of whom I have, any of whom I have earned. But I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it because I don't believe it. I don't believe that this was a war that I can tote up the advantages and disadvantages and say overwhelmingly this is a war that had to be fought and that we had a successful outcome. I can't say that. Because it was a very complex situation. It was complex at the beginning. It was difficult throughout. I know it was. I know what Johnson went through and how he agonized over the war.
Richard Nixon came to office in 1968 having made a promise to President Lyndon Johnson that he would stand with him, that together they would stop the high water mark of communism and stop its spread across Southeast Asia. Richard Nixon stuck by that promise even in these interviews in 1975 because he had made it way back in 1968 while still struggling for his political life.
Nixon was up, way up in the polls until September 30th when Hubert Humphrey turned the tide with this speech.
I want to talk with you about Vietnam.
Humphrey repudiated Lyndon Johnson's war policy.
As president, I would stop the bombing of the North as an acceptable risk for peace.
The announcement would narrow the polls dramatically. Nixon immediately had an unexpected order for his personal aide, Dwight Chapin.
Get President Johnson on the phone.
Who did he say that to?
He said it to me. I had no idea what to do, so I asked Rose Woods, who was Nixon's secretary. She said, call 456-1414 in Washington.
That's the White House number.
That's the White House number, and asked to speak to the president.
Mr. President?
Yes.
I'm awfully sorry to bother you. This is Dick Nixon.
Yes, Dick.
President Johnson was recording the call as Nixon discussed Humphrey's speech.
This will be interpreted, as I'm sure you know, as a dramatic move away from the administration. It's my intention not to move in that direction.
Did you have a sense of how strange that call was?
I felt that it was one of the most intriguing political maneuvers that I had ever heard. For Richard Nixon to be calling Lyndon Johnson, and he's telling the president, I'm with you, not exactly those words, but implying it.
Mondale thinks it's evidence that Johnson might have been rooting against his own party's nominee, his own vice president.
Do you think Johnson wanted Humphrey to win?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I think at the end, the last 2 weeks, he wanted him to win. But I think the early part of the campaign, he was mad at Humphrey. He thought Humphrey wasn't being loyal enough.
Do you think Johnson wanted Nixon to win?
I thought so for a while because he was doing things to help Nixon.
Richard Nixon reiterated it again in 1968 after winning the election.
Well, of course, the point
I haven't stayed in this thing 5 years to throw it away the last 5 weeks.
The point is, too, that you've always, your position has always been basically, as I told you, you've taken the position which was extremely unpopular and which was right. And so therefore, I want to support you on it, and we're going to do it. And there's no question about that. I want you to know that.
Thank you, Dick.
Richard Nixon was a career anti-communist. He came to office determined to change the world by dealing with the philosophy he had opposed his entire career. And by January 29th, 1973, Richard Nixon had changed the world. He had the communist world leveraged against one another. He had brought the country together, ending a decade of divisiveness and turmoil. And he had brought over 550,000 American boys home from Vietnam. On January 29th, 1973, Richard Nixon stood with Abraham Lincoln as one of the two men who had truly saved our Union. He had plans for a second term for welfare reform, health care reform. He had plans for basic income, for restructuring our federal government and returning power to the states, local government, and to the people. Simply, he went to sleep that night certain a generation of peace was at hand, that we were on the verge of mastering our moment, and the best was yet to come.
Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, by less than a single percent of the popular vote.
I had a telephone conversation with the vice president. I know exactly how he felt. I know how it feels to lose a close one.
A victory that left in its wake adversaries who were unwilling to accept the legitimacy of the nation's verdict.
He had a huge store of enemies, many of them felt they were doing the Lord's work or were being patriotic by trying to destroy Richard Nixon.
Good evening. There was a major break in the Watergate trial today. On this day of sentencing, one of the defendants, James McCord, promised to reveal hidden details about the bugging of the Democratic headquarters.